From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron were in the Rose Garden yesterday touting common goals on the economy. But in strategy, in philosophy, they are nowhere near a lockstep. For the UK, the big message is austerity. Here in the US, it's been stimulus and more cautious cuts for now. The two nations are very different, but can we take lessons from their opposing plans of attack? The U.S. economy is growing. The U.K. is still flat in the water. This hour on Point, the U.S., the U.K., stimulus, austerity, and what's next? Later this hour, by the way, we will talk about this week's scathing takedown of Goldman Sachs by an outgoing executive who says the Wall Street giant has lost its moral compass, that it's gone bad. But first, austerity and stimulus. Here in the Rose Garden press conference yesterday with Prime Minister David Cameron at his side, President Obama said the U.S. and U.K. shared economic goals but weren't necessarily employing the same strategies.
The United States and Great Britain are two different economies in two different positions. Their banking sector was much larger than ours. Their capacity to sustain debt was different than ours. And so as a consequence, each of us are going to be taking different strategies and employing different timing. But our objectives are common.
A very politic President Obama standing next to the British Prime Minister yesterday. In the streets of London, they haven't been quite so politic. Here are protesters in London. This is in March of last year. Hundreds of thousands took to the streets to protest austerity measures. Here's the sound.
We're marching today to tell the government that we're against all of the cutbacks they're making. They're too quick, too fast. All of these people here are local government workers, and any one of these could be out of a job next week, thanks to Mr. Cameron.
And many have. Joining me now in our studio, Ken Rogoff, professor of public policy and economics at Harvard University, co-author with Carmen Reinhart of This Time is Different, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly. Ken Rogoff, welcome back. It's always great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from London is Richard Jackman, professor of economics at the London School of Economics, an expert on unemployment and the labor market. Richard Jackman, welcome back to you as well. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
So we're trying to figure out, both to look back at what worked and what didn't and what may have and what may not have. We know there's a lot of subtleties here, but also to look ahead because this debate over spending and cutting is not over. And we know a lot of Europe is in the middle of a lot of austerity right now. The U.S. still thinking about that. Richard Jackman, I'm looking here. This is just 2 days ago in The Guardian out of London, and saying the UK's economy has grown, this is over the period of austerity, has grown 0.2%, while in the same period the US has expanded by 2.2%. The Guardian says a lot more evidence is still to come in, but so far it doesn't look good for Mr. Cameron and his austerity policy. How is it working, Richard Jackman?
Well, I think what they say is absolutely right, that the austerity policies have slowed down the recovery until the coalition's measures came into force during 2010-2011. The economy was growing strongly, about similarly to the States. The growth rate in unemployment had come to an end. But more recently, output has indeed gone flat and unemployment has started to rise again. So I think the comment made by The Guardian is absolutely right, that austerity has contributed to the slower growth rate of the British economy. The point that President Obama made, however, that we've got no choice because we have so much debt, is the point that the government would also make, but in my view is a bit overstated. But to be honest, I'm a bit diffident to say that when Professor Rogoff is with you, because he has done much, much more work on this sustainability of debt issue than I have.
It's a big issue for both countries, for many countries around the world, and certainly in Europe and, of course, in the U.S. right now. Overall, how's Prime Minister Cameron responding? I mean, in the U.S., we're talking about recovery. It's not exactly robust. We've still got high unemployment. We're not creating enough jobs by any means, and we've still got a lot of debt. But the talk here is of recovery. In the U.K., do you hear that, Richard Jackman?
Yes, there is talk of recovery, but the facts are that it hasn't yet happened. Of course, you know, the future is always uncertain. The economy isn't in that bad a state. We've avoided a return to recession. It's nothing like the situation in Greece or Spain, where the economy are really plunging down. But I think if we go on at this very, very slow growth, particularly if in comparison with the United States, where the recovery is so much more powerful, I think more criticism will be levelled at the government. At the moment, it has got away with the argument that because of the debt, we've got no choice. So it's not saying that, you know, the recovery is going very well. All it's saying is we're doing as best we can in this very unpleasant circumstance.
Ken Rogoff with me here in the studio. Help us begin to make sense of this. There is a lot of debt out there, and we know it can cause problems. At the same time, we've seen European countries go for austerity, the UK foremost, and not really get growth. Now, here's the U.S. They've taken a little more, easy on the cuts and let's stimulate, Fed pumping money and so on, President Obama's policy, and we've got 2-point-something% growth now. Is there a lesson to be drawn about this, about whether, you know, the old debates about Keynesian economics and whether severe austerity has its time and place? We're hearing a lot about austerity from Republican candidates on the campaign trail.
Well, let's face it, Europe and the United States are in very different positions, and especially let's look at the continent as opposed to Britain. They have this euro, this common currency, which has been a mess. They've recently stabilized the situation, but that's really cast a pall over the whole world. It's been a big uncertainty. Frankly, the fact that it's calmed down has helped the United States even, but Europe is in recession. So England has, 40% of its trade with continental Europe, and they're in recession. They sell a lot to Spain and Italy. They're in deep recession. So certainly these are economies facing different circumstances. The banking system is very big. As President Obama pointed out, it's even bigger in the United Kingdom. They're sitting on Ireland, a lot of loans out to Ireland, which are still very shaky and potentially could fall on the government's books. So certainly there are very, very different circumstances. And lastly, on debt, world debt is very large, and we shouldn't just be worried about the short run, but how it could be a drag on growth for a decade.
More from The Guardian here. They say this cannot be. This is the growth gap between the UK with its austerity and Obama and the U.S. policy. They say this cannot be pinned on the Eurozone crisis, which only reached its climax last summer. This is The Guardian's piece. They say out in the real world, the most remarkable economic experiment's been taking place between the U.S. and U.K. and Europe, or rather between the stimulus brigade and the austerity mob. And the early evidence in this long-running fiscal trial would suggest that the stimulus brigade are ahead. What do you say, Ken?
Well, the rhetoric's a lot different between the United States and Britain than actually the policy. I mean, if you look at deficit as a share of GDP, President Obama's plan for the coming year calls for something not that different than what I suspect George Osborne will be calling for when he comes out with his speech.
The finance minister, Exchequer.
Going to say he's the finance minister for Great Britain. Certainly, they started out with a bigger deficit. They also, I must say, added a lot of government jobs in the run-up to the crisis. So it's the government employees protesting. And I think it's, a question mark. It's a philosophical question over the longer term. Do you bring life back to the British economy by boosting government jobs, or is the long run in the private sector? And lastly, there is this competition with China over the long run. That's been hammering Italy, Spain, Greece, but to some extent, everyone. That's also a question. Is it with government jobs that you're going to deal with this? Where are the jobs going to come from?
Richard Jackman, the cut austerity philosophy has been cut, and that will increase confidence. And by increasing confidence, you'll increase business activity. And that's the way back. How's that proving out?
Well, I mean, some businesses say that, and other businesses say, well, you can do what you like, but if there's no demand, we're not going to produce. And I think the smaller the business and the nearer you get to the people actually involved with running businesses and talking to the customers, the more the worry is that the tax increases and the loss of employment in the public sector is a bad effect on industry. Of course, interest rates are very important as well, and that is the thing that the government is focused on. They sort of say that if we didn't have austerity, we would have interest rates shooting up in the way that has happened in some parts of the Eurozone. But I think that is to mistake the causes of sovereign debt, unsustainability. The situation in the Eurozone countries is much more difficult than in Britain. In Britain, we had a big devaluation immediately after the financial crisis, and we could have further devaluations if it was needed to keep the economy afloat. in the face of any sort of shocks. So our capacity to pay our debt is much healthier than with Eurozone countries. So I think that is the main difference between our situation and that of continental Europe.
But you've said, on the other hand, looking across the pond, you've said if the U.S. recovery continues and the U.K.'s fails, I'm not sure what you're expecting, but that the U.K. will have to ask some serious questions about the Cameron approach.
Yes, I think so. I think the evidence that the recovery is slower because of austerity is fairly strong. I think the issues to do with, had we had a slower cutbacks, whether that would have had a big effect on the deficit and on debt. I mean, as Professor Rogoff says, if you look at the figures, you could hardly tell the difference between Britain and the United States. The austerity measures just don't show up in the numbers. And that's in part because we were indeed in a worse situation to begin with, and in part because the slower growth rate has worsened the government's fiscal position and hence added to our problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about two ways out of economic crisis, the U.S. versus the U.K., stimulus versus austerity, and how those are working out. Here's David Cameron, just last Monday, back in London, before he came to the States in the House of Commons, defending a proposal to cut low-income family tax credits, hitting back against criticism from Labour Party leader Ed Miliband. Cameron said the cuts were necessary and they had to come from somewhere.
We have a massive budget deficit. Now, if he's not going to support the welfare cap, if he's not going to support the housing benefit cap, if he won't support cuts to legal aid, if he won't support cuts to tax credits, how on earth will we deal with a deficit?
How on earth, and how to bring back the economy and jobs, also an issue. Of course, it's very much alive here in the U.S. as well. Here back in February, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin criticizing President Obama's budget, which had just been released that week, for not sufficiently addressing the deficit at a Christian Science Monitor event.
The biggest challenge facing this country is a fiscal challenge, which affects our economy. This is the president's fourth budget, and it's the fourth time he has decided to just duck the issues, the big issues of the day. He's outsourced leadership to commissions and committees and others, only to more or less disavow their conclusions without putting an alternative on the table.
Without putting an alternative on the table. So we've got two ways here, and we're trying to make sense of them. Richard Jackman joins us from London, professor at the London School of Economics. Ken Rogoff is with me in the studio, Harvard University professor of economics, co-author of This Time is Different, Eight Centuries of Financial Folly. Richard Jackman, from where you sit in London, how does the U.S. balance of stimulus and cuts, cautious cuts, and the call for more in the future, how does it look to you?
Well, I mean, I think it's the right approach as long as it can be understood and accepted that there is a sincere aspiration to cut back public spending as soon as, or at least in the United States case, to reduce the budget deficit as soon as the economy is strong enough to cope with it. In the UK case, as Professor Rogoff mentioned, there is indeed a question about whether a public sector is too large relative to the private sector, and the budget deficit cut should then, in that case, take the form largely of cuts in public spending. But in the United States, it's not for me to judge, but certainly it is the case that the size of the budget deficit in the United States before the financial crisis was quite large, was comparable to that in this country. On current forecasts, it's expected to stay quite large, and I think at some stage, inevitably, that must come to an end. But currently, the United States is under no pressure to do so. Some people say it's because of the peculiar status of the dollar as a reserve currency. In my view, it's just because the United States economy is extraordinarily strong, basically, and it's not really credible that it won't pay its debt. Like Britain, of course, the United States has its own currency, and if the worst comes to the worst, can print some more of it. So there's no real risk of default. So there's no particular reason why the levels of debt are unsustainable. In my view, the necessary adjustment in the fiscal position can be delayed. It's not really an urgent matter at all. In this country, I think it is slightly more urgent, but not as urgent as the government would claim.
Ken Rogoff, that delay has kind of been President Obama's message. Let's do what's necessary to now to first save the economy back after the collapse, then to pull it out of the ditch, try and create jobs. It's going slowly, but it's going at last. But we're raising this because in this campaign season, we're going to hear a lot about this, and we're kind of trying to get a grip on how economists look at this. On the campaign trail, the Republican challengers to President Obama are really going at him, saying we need to cut much, much more. And looking to austerity in Europe as kind of a model. From 30,000 feet, let's say, we'll look at going ahead. But so far, do you think the U.S. has had about the right balance here? Or is it, you know, it's easy to say, well, we'll cut tomorrow. We know that. But has it been about right in your view or not?
Well, as Professor Jackman said, it's all in, do we have a sincere aspiration to fix this over the longer term? And frankly, I don't think this is about President Obama. I don't think it's about the Republicans. I think it's about the voters. I think at the end of the day, the voters, even the Tea Party, say, we want a smaller deficit. But as soon as you tell them, well, can we raise taxes? No. Can we cut spending on anything you like? No, we even want more of it. It's very hard for any politician to really stand up there unless you're someone who's just stepping out of office soon, like Senator Simpson was, who gave a really good, candid assessment. It's true, the timing is not urgent. But on the other hand, this is a big ship. You can't turn it very quickly. And I think we need to plan how we're going to have more tax revenues and a more efficient tax system. And a question mark about how big we want government. They already have national health care in Britain. We are phasing in a very expensive health care program here. They have raised the retirement age already in Britain in ways we haven't been able to broach yet. We haven't been able to think about. So we have a lot of adjustments ahead, which I think will come to the head sometime in the term of this president or whoever is in power after the election.
In the next 4 years.
Yeah, in the next
four or five years. Could the U.S. have gone the U.K. way, the Europe way? I mean, you know, you've got some prominent economist, Paul Krugman, saying, you know, thank heavens we didn't, that it's been a stunning policy failure, that you've got double-dip recessions on the way in a lot of countries in Europe. And he's saying, you know, Keynes redeemed and Europe went the wrong way. Should the U.S. have had more austerity in this time that President Obama has had his hand sort of on the tiller?
Well, I think you could look at the quality of how we spent money between tax cuts and expenditure. I think it was a reasonable policy when we were really facing the abyss. But the fact is, particularly if we look at the United Kingdom, it's not facing the abyss. And I think particularly because Professor Jackman emphasized they have their own currency. They don't have this mess that
they're not part of the euro.
Not part of the euro, which is just a constitutional nightmare. And in the United States, we have that also. But, you know, even if we don't default someday, if everybody thinks we're going to inflate, interest rates are going to go way up for everyone. The United States has very, very short debt. It's not 30-year debt. It's just averaging a few years. Mm-hmm. We have to turn it over. And if markets
say,
hey, we lent you for nothing before. Now we want 5%. And my gosh, you know, that would pile hundreds of billions of dollars into our deficit. So we do need to manage expectations about how we're going to exit from this.
Of course, those interest rates are incredibly low right now. But how long does that last, particularly if the economy comes back? Now, the economy coming back is a big deal. Let's get our listeners in here. Everybody's thinking about this as we look ahead and think about the messages we're hearing from leaders and potential leaders. Ed in Charleston, South Carolina. Ed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering if it's not so much a matter of either or, austerity or stimulus, but a little bit of both. And you mentioned Paul Krugman earlier, and I recall his saying early on in the Great Recession that we need to have both, and I know he's considered, I guess, a liberal economist, but I guess we have evidence for this model of kind of both working in the past, and I don't know if that's fact or not, but wonder what your guests think of that.
Well, let us look at that in a couple of ways. Richard Jackman, I don't know about a straight up, you know, how do you have cuts and stimulus? I mean, net, you're going to either be cutting or putting money in, I suppose, one way or the other. But let's look first at the UK message. The Cameron message was that you can have cuts and growth, that cuts will lead to growth. Has that proved out again, Richard Jackman?
Well, I think it's very difficult to find any direct link. I mean, at the moment, the employment figures which have just come out, rather by coincidence, show that the number of jobs that are being gained in the private sector, which is about 30,000 over the last month, is the same as the number that have been lost in the public sector, which makes it appear maybe that the job cuts in the public sector are enabling the private sector to employ more workers. But actually, in a situation where there are about 3 million unemployed workers, it's evident that there is actually no real shortage of labour. So it can't be necessary to cut back the public sector in order to release labour for the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned already that interest rates is a key area where the austerity rhetoric in particular may be impressing markets and keeping interest rates down, and that will certainly be very helpful for business, although it's currently rather overshadowed by the concern about the banking sector and the banking sector not being prepared to make loans and banks shifting from being ultra risky to ultra cautious operations. Whether businessmen sort of get terribly excited again by the thought of cuts is something which, again, as I mentioned before, is a bit offset by what's going on in the shops. We're not actually selling any goods, so it's not terribly exciting that the government is reducing regulations or whatever. No, I think there's no direct evidence that the cuts are helping, but I'm not. I wouldn't rule out entirely the idea that you could have austerity and spending cuts together, because stimulus together, because I think if you could think of some types of investments that, although they create costs now, can reduce costs in the future, maybe improvements in transport infrastructure or something of that nature, to spend money now on long-term projects which improve the efficiency of the economy in the future.
Let me take that to Ken Rogoff here in the studio. Ken, this has been President Obama's word, invest now, we'll cut over time. We've heard that. The same time we heard from David Cameron, and we're hearing from some on the Republican campaign trail, that when you cut, this lifts confidence. This will prove out in economic growth. What does the UK example say about that insistence, Ken?
Well, first of all, this is a two decade long problem. This is not a thing which ends after a year like a typical recession.
No, but those years one by one matter, particularly to people out of work.
They absolutely matter, but we're looking at a very long problem here that you have to chip away at over time.
Right.
And I think both the U.S. and Britain have been doing it, facing very different circumstances. You know, this may sound like completely out of the box, but we have shale gas that's just an incredible boost for us. It's cutting our borrowing from abroad. It's just an incredible bonanza. I won't go into the environmental issues, but there are big differences between the two countries and what's going on. And again, there are many issues about the size of government with both countries are facing, where they're starting from somewhat different positions, where the UK has national health care. We aspire to having something. And these are big changes. And finally, the competition with Asia, which is just beating up on some of the economies in Europe and also hitting Britain and, of course, hitting some of our states very, very badly also. There are a lot of things going on here, and you just point at, you know, the short-term number and say that must be the government's policy. Last summer, things were looking awful in the United States. Were we, you know, saying that President Obama was doing everything wrong? I certainly wasn't. I mean, and it can change again by next summer.
Would it be good to come in with a change of administrations in this country and really whack down spending right now? There are calls for that. Maybe that would be the thing that would kick it off.
Well, I'd like to see tax reform. I'd like to see a better tax system, getting rid of all the deductions, all the hidden expenditures, of which there's over $1 trillion when you add them up. I mean,
in effect, you're saying more revenue plus cuts, maybe.
Simpler tax system without all these deductions.
But that means more revenue. That's what you're...
Well, I mean, you could cut... You could get more revenue and still give people an incentive to invest, an incentive to work. I mean, that's sort of the magic solution that everyone promotes. But Congress particularly is very resistant. They like giving out the goodies under the table that nobody sees.
Mm-hmm.
They like getting votes this way. They like it's spending basically this way. That's the fix that we need.
Choices coming up when we're trying to figure it out. John in Nashville, Tennessee. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to make a point about austerity. I think the biggest problem Europeans look at is that when austerity measures are enacted, it only seems to affect the people whom can afford it the least. And I've yet seen an austerity program where, except for recently when they decided to do it with Greece, where they're taking a haircut up to 70%, any austerity measures that put the people whom are partly responsible for the problem at risk as well and some level of sacrifice. So if austerity takes place, then it should take place all the way up the line, not just at the level in which the people whom are already in the 3 years of sacrifice are being asked to sacrifice even more.
John, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call. Richard Jackman, how has that element of this played out in the U.K. with David Cameron's austerity, the sort of justice in the middle of all this? And, you know, who pays the price?
Yeah, and I think the government has been very conscious of this concern, and it's been implemented in a sort of rather unsystematic way. But certainly there have been a number of removals of tax exemptions and things which have been specifically targeted at wealthy people. For example, the exemption of pension contributions from taxation has been significantly limited, which has been a great sort of impact mainly on the wealthier people. In other respects, the taxation of banks, for example, has been rather controversial. The tax on bankers' bonuses has been repealed, but it's been replaced by a tax on bank balance sheets, which is sort of less obviously directed at the wealthy. But I think the situation in this country isn't quite as bad as, say, in Greece. In Greece, many people feel that the sort of political elite have caused all the country's problems and are now avoiding the consequences. I mean, that is felt in general about bankers having caused the problem and avoiding the consequences. But specifically within the UK context, I think it would be fair to say the government is acutely sensitive to the concerns that the cuts fall almost, you know, largely on the poor. They are trying to ensure that everybody pays their fair share.
Can we learn here about the if I may, Richard? Trying. Ken Rogoff, for the U.S. this equity issue. I mean, if it's austerity, does that necessarily mean that the weight of addressing the problems we're facing falls unfairly on them that's not got?
The equity issue is a huge problem across the advanced countries, and I think underlying it's not so much the austerity, not so much the financial crisis as trade with Asia, globalization.
Because that's undercutting wages,
it's undercut
jobs.
Lower-income workers, and it's bid up high-income workers who have specialized global skills. That's a problem confronting everybody over the next decade. I must also say there's a big generational problem between young people and old people going on, especially in Europe, also in the United States. Youth unemployment in Spain is almost 50%. In the United States, among, you know, the 20-somethings, it's, you know, way over 15%. It's a dramatic problem.
Talk in a minute about the big resignation blast from a Goldman Sachs executive this week and what it says about that Wall Street giant. Lots of response to this question online. People saying, you know, austerity hurts the poor. People saying stimulus and we never get the debt down. And then there's this. George writes on Facebook, Professor Rogoff, please be bold and tell us how you think U.S. debt should be handled. Slowly, after more recovery, or it's an emergency and we have to tackle it now? How much debt? How long?
Slowly, there's no question. We're still absolutely gasping our way out of this deep recession that we have. We've barely clawed our way back to where we started in 2007, huge unemployment. This is not a time to do something radical. In fact, I would even do more radical monetary policy right now. But no, it's something you have to have a go slow approach. But it's not just about spending. It's about how you do it. Can you improve our tax system? Can you improve the quality of our government? How are we going to handle the health care bill when it comes in 2013?
John Boehner has been saying, you know, President Obama's policies have made our economic woes worse. Republicans on the campaign trail, you know, along the same line, that the strategy's done a lot of damage to the economy, that the country needs austerity, and soon Mitt Romney promises to reduce taxes, you know, very drastically, 20% or something, and quite quickly.
Wait, he's going to reduce taxes to fix the deficit or to fix
spending? Spending.
Sorry. He probably is going to reduce taxes too. Yeah, I mean, but it's another thing when you get in power and you have a look at what that actually implies. It's not that easy to do. I mean, the size of the U.S. government's just not that large. Maybe not that efficient, but we're not like a Sweden or a Canada, which after their financial crises really had a lot of fat to prune. It's just not as easy in the States.
I'm looking here. This is an assessment by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. This is a bipartisan nonprofit. We've had the representatives on many times, and they're very, very eager to get the deficit down. They've been looking at the campaign plans put forward by Republican candidates here. And look, President Obama's got his own deficit looming out there. But they're pointing out that if you cut spending but you don't raise revenue over 10 years, they're saying the Gingrich plan would actually increase the national deficit by $7 trillion. Rick Santorum's by $4.5 trillion. Mitt Romney's by $250 billion. What do you see coming in the plans you're hearing, broad as they may be, on the campaign trail, Ken?
Well, I don't think anything's going to bring it into balance over the next 10 years. I mean, it's going to be a very long time before we're talking about balance.
But these are increases of trillions.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy the idea that cutting spending would have more debt than you would if you didn't cut spending. It doesn't mean you have a better life. I don't think there's what we call a debt Laffer curve, which means if you run a bigger deficit today, you have less debt tomorrow. That's a theoretical possibility, but sort of defies common sense. But I think the candidates are largely skirting around the issue of the big flaws in the system, all the under-the-table tax deductions and mm-hmm. such that everybody gets. I mean, of course, Mitt Romney's tax rate came up in the campaign, but this affects a lot of people. You know, why is the tax system so favor certain types of income over others?
David in Des Moines, Iowa. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a very interesting conversation, but isn't the real crisis the jobs crisis and the fundamental maldistribution of wealth in the country? I mean, it reminds me very much of the 1920s where you really have a structural flaw in the country in the sense that you don't have the kind of purchasing power that you need among working people. And by cutting back government spending, you're essentially contributing to that problem.
Let us pick it right up. Ken Rogoff, what about it? Is that the basic problem here now? Or, I mean, you never seem to lose sight of the deficit at the same time, but you hear David's concern.
Oh, of course that's the central issue. You want to have people's welfare and happiness improve over time. That's the goal. The deficit's just an instrument towards that you don't want to have crises. You don't want to have huge slow growth because of that. And I think the inequality is a problem. I don't think there's any doubt that the overarching problem is not the financial crisis. It's not how the government spends its money in the short run. It is globalization, its long-term effects, technology, its long-term effects, how we're dealing with this. These are, you know, things where I certainly say would argue towards having a more equitable tax system than the one we have, but I don't think it argues towards just having government jobs. I mean, Britain actually did that in the run-up mm-hmm. to the crisis, but I don't think you have to explain to people that in the long run, that's not what's going to create a vibrant economy.
Professor Jackman in London. We've seen the British Prime Minister in the U.S. this week, very affable and polite with the American president. They seem to get on well, but he's got a different message for his people than Barack Obama has had for the American people. Do you see Cameron sticking with the austerity message? Do you see his conservative government staying in power if he does?
I was interested with the comments about cutting the deficit and whether it was possible. Because, I mean, even on the current government's austerity plans, the deficit in Britain is going to remain one of the highest in the OECD over the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's really our austerity plans are really very sort of chicken feed type austerity plans. It's not real serious austerity.
Wow.
So I think the government can stick with it because it's not actually terribly major.
More talk than
particularly
than
if the economy. I think mm-hmm. the key thing, like Professor Rogoff was saying, is whether the economy recovers. If the economy recovers despite the austerity measures, then things will be okay. But if it doesn't, then I think the comparisons between the stagnation in Britain and the growth in other countries, particularly the states, will become an increasing political embarrassment for the government.
Richard Jackman at the London School of Economics, we're very grateful to you for your time and insights today, Professor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ken Rogoff, Harvard University author of co-author, This Time is Different. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much, Ken, for coming in.
Thank you.
In a moment, a scathing charge of ethical failure from an outgoing Goldman Sachs executive. This is On Point. Yesterday, the New York Times published a blistering essay by a resigning Goldman Sachs executive, Greg Smith, written as he left the Wall Street giant. Smith was head of Goldman's U.S. equity derivatives business in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. In his essay, which has drawn global attention, he says the fabled firm's current leaders have lost Goldman Sachs' once vaunted values, that its culture has turned viciously self-serving, in Smith's words, toxic and destructive. Here's an excerpt read by my WBUR colleague, Jack Lipiars.
Today, many of these leaders display a Goldman Sachs culture quotient of exactly 0%. I attend derivative sales meetings where not one single minute is spent asking questions about how we can help clients. It's purely about how we can make the most possible money off them. If you were an alien from Mars and sat in on one of these meetings, you'd believe that a client's success or progress was not part of the thought process at all. It makes me ill how callously people talk about ripping their clients off. Over the last 12 months, I have seen five different managing directors refer to their own clients as Muppets, sometimes over internal email. Even after the SEC, Fabulous Fab, Abacus, God's Work, Carl Levin, Vampire Squids, no humility? I mean, come on. Integrity? It is eroding. I don't know of any illegal behavior, but will people push the envelope and pitch lucrative and complicated products to clients, even if they are not the simplest investments or the ones most directly aligned with the client's goals? Absolutely. Every day, in fact. It astounds me how little senior management gets a basic truth. If clients don't trust you, they will eventually stop doing business with you. It doesn't matter how smart you are. These days, the most common question I get from junior analysts about derivatives is, how much money did we make off the client? It bothers me every time I hear it because it is a clear reflection of what they are observing from their leaders about the way they should behave. Now project 10 years into the future. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that the junior analyst sitting quietly in the corner of the room hearing about Muppets, ripping eyeballs out, and getting paid doesn't exactly turn into a model citizen. When I was a first-year analyst, I didn't know where the bathroom was or how to tie my shoelaces. I was taught to be concerned with learning the ropes, finding out what a derivative was, understanding finance, getting to know our clients and what motivated them, learning how they define success and what we could do to help get them there. My proudest moments in life, getting a full scholarship to go from South Africa to Stanford University, being selected as a Rhodes Scholar National finalist, winning a bronze medal for table tennis at the Maccabiah Games in Israel, known as the Jewish Olympics, have all come through hard work with no shortcuts. Goldman Sachs today has become too much about shortcuts and not enough about achievement. It just doesn't feel right to me anymore. I hope this can be a wake-up call to the board of directors. Make the client the focal point of your business again. Without clients, you will not make money. In fact, you will not exist. Weed out the morally bankrupt people no matter how much money they make for the firm and get the culture right again so people want to work here for the right reasons. People who care only about making money will not sustain this firm or the trust of its clients for very much longer.
The essay that appeared this week in the New York Times by outgoing Goldman Sachs executive Greg Smith. Joining me now to discuss this very public criticism of the Wall Street giant is William D. Cohan. He's a Bloomberg View columnist who worked on Wall Street for 17 years, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
What did you make of this essay?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's extraordinary because it was written at all. I mean, at Goldman Sachs and across much of Wall Street, there's a very tight, what I refer to as omerta. In other words, it's a very closed society, a very closed culture.
Vow of silence. You don't talk about the family businesses.
Exactly. You know, you don't dare dirty laundry in public or anything close to it. So, as to my knowledge, and I've studied Goldman Sachs extensively, this is the first time in my experience that anything like this has ever appeared, in public, let alone on the op-ed page of the New York Times.
And it's made a lot of waves. I mean, Goldman stock was really off yesterday, and people are talking about this thing everywhere.
Yes. Well, Goldman stock being off is a separate matter, I think, because it was up big the day before after the stress tests were released. People are talking about it because, you know, part of it is people, you know, have this visceral fantasy of wanting to be able to tell your employer where to get off, and that we all sort of dream about that, and very few of us can actually do it. This guy did it publicly on the pages of the New York Times. And secondly, because much of what he writes about is true, although we don't know really his circumstances and what drove him to do this. I mean, you know, if it's sour grapes, that's one thing. If he just decided one day I've had enough of this and he's saintly, then, you know, more power to him.
He says, you know, that the client's interests just, you know, take the hindmost. And you've got managing directors talking about them as Muppets and as though they couldn't care less. He says, not illegal, but he says it's toxic and destructive. He's describing a kind of ethical vacuum here, and he's laying it right on the top leadership of Goldman Sachs today. What do you say to that?
Look, Goldman Sachs and the rest of Wall Street, these are not charitable organizations. In fact, no corporation in the world is in business to do anything but make money.
Well, and maybe never has been, but we haven't seen this kind of broadside all that often.
Well, we've never seen this kind of broadside. That's the incredible thing about it. Except from, say, Senator Carl Levin in April 2010, or the SEC also in April 2010, where they just lit into Goldman Sachs relentlessly, Carl Levin did for 11 hours, saying many of the same things. These are many of the same things that I talk about in my book. It's not, you know, the surprising thing is not the content of what he wrote, because I think many people are aware of this and yet still do business with Goldman Sachs for many reasons. The incredible thing is that a vice president, after 12 years of feeding at the trough of Goldman Sachs, would turn around and write this scathing, attack against the firm.
I mean, there. You say it's always gone on, but there was this notion of Goldman values that were supposed to be different, that it was long-term greed, not short-term. Do the right thing day by day, and it adds up to the right thing long-term. Greg Smith says that's gone.
I know that there are these principles that Goldman Sachs has written down in the 1970s, and then now everybody speaks about them, and they're like the gospel at the firm. But I could tell you stories about, and I wrote in my book, about what Goldman Sachs did in 1929 and 1930, what Goldman Sachs in the Great Depression, what Goldman Sachs did in 1970 leading up to the bankruptcy of the Penn Central Bank, a railroad company, that would turn your stomach because they were so focused on doing what was best for Goldman and its partners and not for its clients. I mean, the firm almost went out of business in both 1929 and 1930 because of what it had done, and in the same 1969 and 1970. Nobody thinks about that, but this kind of self-interested behavior of Goldman Sachs has been going on through much of its history. So this is not anything. I mean, I don't know why he's waking up to this now after 12 years of working there. This has been going on for a long time. You know, it was couched in a more genteel culture, like, oh, no, we really care about our clients and we're in this for the long term. And, you know, if we make money, if they make money. But the fact of the matter is, I could point to you chapter and verse, and it's in my book, where the exact opposite has happened, and where Goldman put itself first, took care of itself first, and then worried about its clients. In fact, many of its clients ended up suing Goldman Sachs and almost putting the firm out of business.
Fair enough, but here we are with our own dire circumstances in our own time, and you write about the Goldman constructing the big short against the mortgage market. They got $4 billion out of it, and we saw where the economy headed up. I mean, it is so powerful on Wall Street that it leaves, I think, regular people wondering if we've got some kind of degree of moral corruption there that's a problem for our economic system. You call this an existential moment for Goldman.
Yes.
What about that? And what about the broader economy if you've got this kind of approach right there in the heart of it?
It's hugely existential threat for our country. We saw that in the crash in 2008, throughout 2008. I mean, the bad behavior on Wall Street, the wrong incentives on Wall Street that continue to go on, nothing has changed. That is what nearly brought our country and the world economy to its knees. And that has not really been fixed, not by 2,300 pages of Dodd-Frank law, not by all the regulations being rewritten. The incentives on Wall Street of encouraging people to take risks with other people's money still exist, and that hasn't changed one iota. This is an existential threat, not only for Goldman, but for our whole economy and our country and the way, you know, once upon a time Wall Street was revered because it raised capital for its clients anywhere in the world, whenever they needed it. It provided sound M&A advice on deals. It provided investment advice. But it's really become more like a casino in the last 25 years, and that is a big problem for the rest of us, as we found out in 2007 and 2008.
William D. Cohen, he's author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, worked on Wall Street 17 years. Lazard Frere was a managing director at J.P. Morgan Chase. Op-ed on this in the Financial Times today. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. William Cohen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You can also find links to Greg Smith, his explosive New York Times op-ed, at our website. Again, onpointradio.org, the outgoing Goldman Sachs executive. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.